Plato's dialogues are filled with myths. Virtually every Platonic dialogue has some little narrative in it, usually a real gem of a narrative that takes up themes and images from Greek mythology and weaves them into a new kind of story. And it's very interesting to contemplate what these myths mean. And to ask oneself the question, what is the possible role of myth in philosophy? What's the relationship of myth to philosophy? The Greek word mythos just means story or narrative. If you want to use that concept very broadly, then everything about the Platonic dialogues is a narrative, right? All the dialogues are stories. There's one event, and then another event, and then another event, and they're all narrated or acted out in front of us. However, within the dialogues are more specifically fictional stories, the myths of Plato. And the question that intrigues me is, why does Plato write myths? And what possible good are myths in the pursuit of wisdom, which is what philosophy is all about? Isn't philosophy, in some sense, an emancipation from myth? If you look at the history of thought, you find that every known culture has a set of myths. And these myths are always about gods, heroes, demigods, life after death in one form or another. And the fifth major topic are the men of old, the ancient men, especially the first men. Every culture has myths about these five topics. Again, gods, demigods, heroes, ancient men, and the afterlife. Not every culture has a myth about the origin of the cosmos. The term for a creation myth is a cosmogony, an account of the genesis or the origin of the cosmos. Myth is primitive in some sense. Myth is always associated with the origins of culture, the origins of civilization. And philosophy, whatever it is, isn't primitive. Philosophy always comes later, after myth, usually, if it comes about at all, many thousands of years after the origin of a civilization. And the origin of philosophy always involves a kind of gesture of emancipation, the emancipation of the mind from opinion. And opinion just means any views that are just passed down from generation to generation, and those would include myths. This is true of all three independent philosophical traditions. There are three independent philosophical traditions. There's the Indian tradition, the Chinese, and the Western tradition, which really means the Greek and post-Greek tradition of philosophy. All of those begin in some way with gestures of the emancipation of the mind from ancestral opinions and customs, and an attempt to turn towards some other kind of source of knowledge in order to give us a picture of man and his nature and his place in the overall system of the cosmos, and also some understanding of the right way of life. Every myth is a philosophy, if you will, a primitive philosophy. And what does it mean to say myth is a kind of primitive philosophy? Well, philosophies all deal with these topics: man's nature, the cosmos, our place in the cosmos, our status, if you will, the human condition, and the good life. Now, every myth takes the form of a story. They're always stories, they're always narratives, and they always involve concrete events, and usually concrete characters. Now, sometimes these characters are gods or demigods, other times they're personifications of phenomena. For instance, here's an example of an old myth. This is a Latin myth, and it goes something like this. Care was walking along the river. Now here we have personification of a force, care. Right? Care is walking along the river, and she bends down and she scoops up some mud, and she forms it into a creature. She calls upon Jupiter to breathe life into it. And then she decides to name it. But of course, this creates a problem because the earth has donated the stuff that it's made out of, right, the mud, and Jupiter has donated its principle of life, its soul. Although she has manufactured it, she doesn't have complete claim over the thing, and so the three forces, Jupiter, the Earth, and Care, begin arguing about what to name it. Okay, what do we name this new creature? And they settled the dispute this way. Earth, because it gave its substance, will receive the substance back when it's dead. Zeus, or Jupiter, who gave it its soul, will receive the soul back after it's dead. And Care, because it manufactured this creature, will possess it throughout its entire life, and they decided to name the creature Homo, man, from humus, earth. And so this is a myth about the origin of man, and it's specifically a myth about the fact that Care possesses us throughout our lives. Well, what does that mean? We're always worrying about something. We are always concerned about things. And this myth is an attempt to give us some reason or some account, some explanation for why human life is always beset with worries and cares. So every myth has a narrative structure, concrete specific events, and concrete characters. Yet every myth tries to deal with something of universal significance. And the most universally significant things are, again, man's nature, the cosmos, our place in the cosmos, and what the good life is. Now, these are the topics that philosophy deals with as well. It would seem, therefore, that philosophy and myth are going to be quarreling with one another eventually, because both of them are attempts, using different methods, to try and answer the same basic kinds of questions. Now, one thing that philosophy does when it encounters myth is it brings to myth a new kind of critical intellect. Primitive peoples, peoples who exist entirely in the atmosphere of myth, tend to have rather uncritical minds. Some of them believe the literal truth of myths. Yet it's very clear that myths can't be literally true for the most part. They involve violations of easily known laws of causality. What does it mean to say that Care is a person? Why is Care given a female gender? None of these things can literally be true. Many myths are clearly relative to time and place, and they undergo all kinds of transformations, sometimes for the most obvious pragmatic reasons. For instance, there's a beautiful book by a French author named Paul Bain called Did the Greeks Believe Their Myths? And the reason why that question makes sense is if you look at Greek mythology, you see that the Greeks were rather cavalier about changing the mythology. Why would they change it? Well, sometimes they change it to suit their political purposes. For instance, if Athens came to dominate some other Greek city-state, one of the ways that they would legitimize this new state of affairs would be to rewrite the founding myths of the newly dependent society to legitimate its new circumstances. Now, this seems terribly cynical, and the question then becomes, well, how can people really believe myths if they treat them in such a cynical way? It is an important question. Well, the Greeks believed their myths, but they clearly didn't believe that they were literally true, if anybody could transform them for completely pragmatic purposes. But clearly they did have some kind of claim on people's credence. People were very powerfully motivated by these myths. People understood themselves and their place in the world in terms of these myths. They answered the most fundamental questions any human being can raise in terms of these things. They certainly spent lavish amounts of time and energy building temples and endowing them and worshiping at them and holding festivals in honor of these gods. So clearly they believed them in some sense. It had the power to command people's actions, yet they didn't seem to believe that they were literally true, but there was got to be some other kind of truth here. Well, a parable is just a particular kind of story that has a meaning to it or a moral to it, like a fable. Aesop, right, has all these little fables or parables. And if you look at sometimes a parable, it will have all the hallmarks of myth. there will be talking animals or forces of nature personified, things like that. There's generally not that much difference between a myth and a parable. The thing that's extraordinary is that myths are clearly not believed to be literally true once you start looking at them with a critical mind. They're filled with contradictions, and therefore we know they can't be literally true. And if you look from one mythic tradition to another, they're so radically different in many ways that all of them can't be true. What's going on here is we're applying certain basic principles of logic, like contradictions can't exist in reality, right? So contradictory stories can't be true. Or we're applying a correspondence theory of truth, which says that a story is true if and only if it mirrors the way the world really works. Myths can't be true in that sense because they don't mirror the way the world really works, so that we have to think that they're false in some way. Philosophy inaugurates a kind of critical attitude towards myth. And it's part of philosophy's attempt to emancipate itself from myth that leads to a conflict between philosophy and myth. They're dealing with the same issues. Philosophy, however, deals with these issues in a much more rigorous and intellectually, if you will, clear and lucid way. Philosophy tries generally to speak in terms of abstractions, not in terms of concrete stories. Philosophical treatises and discussions generally don't take the form of stories. Open any journal of philosophy in America today, and none of the articles begin "Once Upon a Time." If you go to Borders and go through the books in the philosophy section, none of them begin "Once Upon a Time." None of them have characters in them. It's a very different kind of speech. There's a kind of attempt on the part of philosophy to become timeless, to emancipate itself from the relativity of any particular culture and historical epoch. Philosophy attempts to speak to all men in some way. This is why mathematics has always been such a tempting model for philosophers, because it's a kind of language that has a greater universality than any natural language, which is tinged with history and custom and relativity to time and place. So it seems like philosophy would be the last place that you'd expect myths to be popping up. And yet, when you reach Plato, who is the first philosopher in the Western tradition, whose complete works have survived. I would argue that Aristophanes is Clouds as a philosophic work, but most other people wouldn't put him in the canon, so Plato is first. Plato is the first thinker in the Western canon, first philosophical thinker in the Western canon, from whom any single complete work survives. And as it turns out, all of his works have survived. And yet, if you look at all of his works, except for his letters, They're myths. They're narratives. They're dialogues, which are narratives, and within these dialogues are little narratives as well. So what's going on here? Why did Plato regard myth as necessary for philosophy? From the very beginning, the assumption has been that there were 35 Platonic dialogues, and we can count. The assumption is that all of his works have survived. We know that Plato destroyed his early poetic works, but all of his philosophical works have survived. Dialogues are kind of plays, right? Which means that they're narratives in the very broad sense, because the word mouthos in Greek just means a narrative or a story. Then there's a more specific sense of mouthos, which we use when you talk about the power of myth, when you open a Joseph Campbell book or something and read about myth. It's full of talking animals and personified forces of nature and stories about gods, demigods, heroes, the netherworld, first men, and so forth, the creation of the cosmos. Those kinds of myths are also found within the Platonic dialogues. And they're clearly not just reports on accepted Greek myths. They take up elements of the Greek mythology and also foreign mythologies, too, and weave them together in strange ways to come up with something that's entirely different. And the question is, why mythologize? Why did Plato feel it necessary to mythologize? Now, well, we don't have any of the works that Aristotle published in his lifetime. Aristotle wrote dialogues, just like Plato did. Apparently, they were kind of different than the Platonic dialogues, because they were actually more like the Timaeus, which consists of a little bit of dialogue and then a big, long speech. And apparently Cicero modeled his dialogues on the Aristotelian model, and his tend to contain long speeches by people with different opposing viewpoints. But Aristotle did write dialogues, and those are the only things he published. And every single Aristotelian dialogue has been lost. Only fragments embodied as quotations in the texts of other authors have survived. All of the writings that we have of Aristotle were works that he never intended for publication and that came to light long after his death. Actually, 80 BC is the date when most of these things seem to have come to light. The Roman dictator Sulla found these texts in Asia Minor and brought them back, and it was during that period that they were edited and widely disseminated. Aristotle didn't write Socratic dialogues. They were more collections of speeches that were by different characters, but they were very long speeches. There was none of this Socratic question and answer thing. It was more like debates rather than dialogues. They were not conversational. We know this from reports and also from the fact that these are the way Cicero's dialogues are written, and he modeled his dialogues on Aristotle. The thing that's important about Aristotle is that none of the works that we have under his name were published during his lifetime. And there are all kinds of questions about which of these works are really Aristotle's. And a lot of works have been excluded or included, and it's been fertile ground for classicists who love to make arguments about authenticity, sometimes on the craziest and most spurious of grounds. It doesn't really matter from the point of view of a person who's just interested in wisdom whether Aristotle wrote these things or not. There's a joke that I find very amusing. A classicist rushes in to his class, all excited, and announces the most momentous discovery, that Homer was not the author of the Iliad and the Odyssey, but instead it was a different Greek with the same name. and of course it's absurd, because the only thing we know about Homer is that he was named Homer and he wrote the Iliad and the Odyssey. But the same thing sort of goes as far as disputing the authenticity of one text or another. If you're a classicist, it's always tempting. Or if you got an axe to grind and you don't like what this text says, you can always say, well, that's not the authentic work. But if you're just interested in pursuing wisdom, well, it doesn't matter who wrote these things, really. You can say that they were all written by Homer for all the good that it does. It makes no difference at all. One of the most important texts in Plato's corpus for the question about myth is the Phaedrus. Now, the Phaedrus is extremely beautiful. It's Plato's most poetic dialogue, and it contains a number of myths that are really wonderful. And at the beginning, it has a little reflection on the nature of myth. Socrates and Phaedrus are outside the walls of Athens, and they find a shaded, sylvan spot near a stream. And Phaedrus asks Socrates if this is a particular place where Boreas bore off this young girl, Boreas being a wind god. And he said, no, that's further down the stream, actually. And then they get talking about myths because, of course, Phaedrus is a product of the Sophists. He's educated by them, associates with them. And the Sophists were, in a sense, an outgrowth of the earliest Greek philosophers known as the natural philosophers. And Greek natural philosophy really is the beginning of Greek philosophy, and it is the most radically uncompromising in its critique of the mythic self-consciousness. Again, philosophy always begins with an attempt to emancipate thought from myth and opinion. And how do you do that? Well, you go back to nature and try and use nature as your guide. The early Greek natural philosophers like Thales, who's really the first Greek philosopher, were therefore extremely critical of myth, and one of the things that they tried to do to eliminate their rival was to show that myth was just a primitive form of science, and that they were going to replace it with a less primitive form of science, namely natural philosophy, which used reason to explain things, and explain things in terms of mechanical causes and forces. And so one of the things that they would do is they would take up the Greek myths and they would give allegorical interpretations of them that would turn them into just fanciful accounts of natural phenomena. They would demythologize the myths, in other words. And this demythologizing activity was very popular. And Socrates deals with the question of demythologizing. And he says, well, I can appreciate the labors of the demythologizers. They have a huge task on their hands. Because not only do they have to explain how some little girl disappeared, if it not by the wind god, maybe she was blown over the rock and drowned in the stream below. Maybe that's the natural explanation, right? But then they have to deal with the Pegasuses and the Chimeras, all the strange monsters of mythology, and explain those in naturalistic terms, too. And the multi-headed Typhon and other things like that. And he says, but you know, I have no time for this. Because I'm still trying to know myself. I want to know if I am a multi-headed Typhonic monster or something altogether more gentle and noble in nature. And the word gentle is atufos, the opposite of Typhon, which Typhon is the monster from which you get the word typhoon, right? This extravagant force of nature, this extravagant, destructive, many-headed force of nature, right? And it's a beautiful little speech he gives for this reason. Socrates is indicating that he doesn't have time to demythologize the world because he's more interested in himself than he is in nature. And so what Socratic philosophy represents is a turn from a full kind of philosophy that's centered on science and nature, natural philosophy, towards a philosophy that centers itself on man. It's a kind of humanistic turn. And the central questions that it deals with are questions of our place, our man's nature, our place in the world, and what is the good life. And Socrates, concerned as he is with the nature of man, finds these myths very useful, and that's why he says, I'm more interested in finding out if I'm a typhonic, medi-headed beast or something of a gentler nature. With this gesture of using these myths as kind of symbols for understanding different ways that he himself can be, he's showing the relevance of myth to his humanistic conception of philosophy. Myth is a tool for self-understanding. Scientists have no need for myth. They think they can replace it. But humanists, who are trying to understand themselves, start having to grapple with the darkness of the soul. And it is very dark and hard to understand. And once you start grappling with it, you find that these stories and these images, these wild beasts and so forth from mythology, are extremely helpful for understanding our souls. And this is what the purpose of Platonic mythologizing is. The first argument I want to make is this. Plato writes myths because he's a humanist interested in self-knowledge. He's starting with himself and trying to understand his place in the whole. And in order to do that, he finds that myth is a very helpful thing to do. Now, why is myth helpful when you're trying to know yourself? That brings us to a second topic. Okay? And that second topic is this. Science always understands the universal. There's no such thing as a scientific understanding of a particular thing. If you go to a scientist, say an anthropologist, and say, help me to understand myself, the anthropologist can say, well, you're a Homo sapiens sapiens, and he can tell you a lot about the species you belong to and our evolution and our primitive ancestors. But if you say, no, I want to know about me, he's going to say, I'm sorry, I don't know anything about you. I don't know anything about you as an individual. And we might send you on to other natural scientists. You go to somebody who studies anatomy, and they can talk about the general anatomical nature of your body. But again, you might say, but I want to know about my body. And he says, well, I don't know. Go look in the mirror. Science doesn't have any understanding of individuality or particularity. And for this reason, it doesn't have to. It's really interested in understanding general natures. It speaks to the universal. It speaks in terms of species and generalities. When we need to talk about individuals, how do we do that? What kind of language is necessary to talk about individuals? Well, Plato doesn't think that talk about universals is sufficient for grasping the nature of what's particular and individual. And yet, he's not just interested in the human condition in general, he's also interested in knowledge of the self, of the individual in particular. And this is why he needs a different kind of speech, if you will, a different way of speaking than the scientist. Now, scientists talk in terms of generalities, whereas he always talks about individuals and particulars. And how do you do that? You tell stories, narratives, and you use language poetically. What is poetic language? Well, all language consists of universal terms, right? Universal categories. Trees, plants, flowers, you know. You can talk about a man being tall or short. All of these are generalities, general terms. How is it there, then, that one can talk about something concrete in particular in general terms? Well, one uses language poetically. What poets do is they take language and they use it to evoke something completely concrete and particular. They tell stories. It's another way of dealing with the concrete and particular. And so Plato writes dialogues which narrate concrete events and give us signs about the nature of the individual characters in them. And he can't do this if he were writing treatises. One of the things that's very clear about most academic philosophy today is not only is there no narrative and there are no characters in the texts, they're written in such a way that completely effaces the individuality of the writer, for the most part. Every journal article could be written by the same person, pretty much. Their individuality is completely effaced. This is part of the whole scientific model of academic philosophizing, right? You efface your personality. It's just the facts. There's nothing creative or artistic about it. And maybe for good reason. No scientist writes about himself when he writes reports. He's talking about nature. If you follow that scientific model, then there's no need to talk about the self. Plato believes, though, that man is at the center of his philosophy, and the individual is at the center of his philosophy. And therefore, he has to tell stories that narrate concrete events and give us insight into the characters of particular human beings. So he writes poetically. That's why he writes myths. So a second reason for Platonic myths is simply this, that the language of myth is the only kind of language that can capture concrete particularity. You know, one of the things that people do when they go to psychotherapists is, again, they're dealing with their particular concrete individual lives. They're trying to deal with that. Applications of science to individuals is of course possible and necessary. But for the most part, when you look at scientific discourse, it'll talk about you in general terms, you as a human being, as a biological being, as a cultural being, as whatever. But you in concrete individuality, no. And to do that, you really have to have a kind of encounter, a person-to-person encounter with somebody else. A person-to-person encounter with a scientist, if you will. There's a third reason that I want to go into now for why I think Plato does myths. Again, the first reason is simply this, that mythic images and stories are very helpful for understanding ourselves. The second reason is a reason about the language of myth. The mythic poetic use of language is absolutely necessary for a philosophy that regards individuality, concrete individuality is important. And again, why? Well, because it's primarily a moral philosophy. It involves, you know, the self-realization of concrete individuals. That's the kind of goal it has. Now, the third reason is this. The early Greek philosophers, because they were just starting out, had a sort of glimpse, this kind of intuition about what philosophy could be. They didn't have it fully worked out. They were just beginners. And they had some rather remarkable ambitions. The assumption was that one could use reason to completely replace opinion, custom, myth, pre-scientific, pre-rational ways of understanding the self and the world. Their assumption was, in short, that reason's power was enormously great, and that in principle it was autonomous, meaning that it could stand on its own and it didn't require supplementation by any other external power, if you will. So reason can stand on its own, and by being rational, man can stand on his own and achieve a kind of autonomy where at the core of each life is the mind, and the mind is emancipated through reason. And the man has taken up a radically different stature, a different stance because of this. We're no longer beholden to all kinds of nonsense that's been handed down to us from the past that we accept on trust, right? What we believe and what allows us to run our lives is entirely rationally justified. And that means that it's all our own. We're not living on borrowed ideas. Reason allows us to be completely responsible for the views that we have. All the views that we hold will be our own views. And that means that we're no longer beholden to others and have to trust others and traditions and so forth for the knowledge necessary to run our lives. Isn't that a wonderful thought? It really does represent a radical kind of human emancipation. Emancipation from the past, emancipation from other people, a kind of individualism, a kind of standing on one's own. Now, Plato rejects this conception of reason. Why? Well, because as philosophy wore on and developed from over several generations up to his own time, it became clear to him that philosophy, as a purely rational form of discourse, couldn't say anything about the questions that were most important to him. We've already seen how he regarded this demythologizing kind of philosophy as inadequate for dealing with the knowledge of the individual soul, which is absolutely crucial. But Plato's turn towards practical life and towards the cultivation and the care of the soul forced him to come to this kind of recognition. He came to this conclusion. He says that we need to talk about all of these things in order to care for the soul. We need to talk about gods, demigods, heroes, the netherworld, the first or earliest man, and the creation of the cosmos in order to carry out the activity, the very practical first-person activity of knowing ourselves and also cultivating ourselves and caring for the soul. This is why so many of the Platonic dialogues involve myths about the afterlife and the underworld. Because the recognition is this, that we cannot care for our souls in this life unless we have some idea of their nature and destiny. But reason can't tell us anything about this. Why? Because reason ultimately has to go back in some way to experience. This was certainly the model of the earlier Greek philosophers. They would observe natural phenomena and then generalize on the basis of natural phenomena and come up with various conclusions. If reason can't speak about these things, the Greek natural philosophers were happy to say, well, we will just remain silent. And really, if your primary concern is just understanding the cosmos as a scientist, right, doesn't really matter if you can't talk about the netherworld or demigods or heroes or things like that. It's not interesting. If you're concerned with a scientific description of reality as it appears to you and as you can understand it and explain it naturalistically, not being able to talk about that is just fine. It's all well and good. Plato, however, Socrates, however, were concerned with moral philosophy primarily. They were concerned with, again, the self-knowledge and self-cultivation. Because they had this central concern with self-knowledge and self-cultivation, they realized that giving speeches about these things, these themes from myth, was not something they could dispense with. They had to say something about them. Yet, as philosophers, they couldn't say anything about them. So what did they have to do? Well, first of all, they recognize that there's a limitation on philosophy. Philosophy is limited in its ability to speak about the first things, the ultimate things. Yet, as human beings who are trying to live and do the best we can in practical life, in self-cultivation, we have to say something about the first things. So what do we need to do? Well, philosophy needs to return to myth. However, it can't just return to myth in a completely credulous and irresponsible way. It can't forget all that it's learned about reason, about intellectual responsibility and clarity and coherence and so forth. It can't forget all that stuff. So there's no going home in the sense of returning to a completely naive, pre-philosophical state of mind. Okay? That's a perennial temptation for people, though. Many people become reflective and intellectual, and it just makes them feel alienated and unhappy. And they look around and they see simple, doltish, unquestioning people, and they envy them. If life could only be that simple. Ignorance is bliss. If only I could be that ignorant again. Well, there's no going back, right, to that state of ignorance. However, it is possible to return to mythic consciousness with a more critical eye. And this is what Plato does. And how does Plato return to mythic consciousness with a more critical eye? Well, there are two basic principles that he brings to bear in returning to myth. And the first and primary principle is this. The gods have to be good. Now, this pretty much blows away all of Greek mythology, which is filled with awful gods. But Socrates and Plato both argue that the cosmos is good. And if you want to understand the cosmic forces personified in terms of gods, then the gods have to be good. And using this principle, which they believe that they can validate rationally, they can criticize virtually the entire body of Greek mythology and cast out any of the things that are contrary to this. A second premise, or second principle that follows again from the assumption that the cosmos overall is run justly, or the cosmos overall is good, is the idea that the afterlife has to be just. Okay, now what does that mean? Well, unlike the Greeks who believed that when you died, most of us would just go down to Hades and sort of fade away into nothingness over a very long period of time. The good and the bad alike all sort of pretty much were thrown down together in this great pit. The very, very bad were subjected to certain torments, and the very, very good could become demigods, right? But most of us were treated pretty much as all of the same cloth and just sort of tossed into the pit. Now, this is a ghastly and unjust view of the cosmos. And so at the end of the last dialogue we looked at in the previous class, the Gorgias, Socrates lays out, which is probably his earliest myth about the afterlife. And basically, there are three different categories. There are the Isles of the Blessed, where the people who are good go. It's like heaven, right? All the bad people go to Tartarus, but there are two kinds of bad people. One kind, the smallest kind, are the incorrigibly rotten. And the incorrigibly rotten are simply tormented for all eternity as an example to others, as a deterrence to others. However, the majority of bad people are curably bad, and therefore they undergo a kind of purgation in the afterlife. It's a kind of purgatory. And they can eventually, it is hoped, graduate after they have been severely punished for a long period of time to go on to the Isles of the Blessed. Now, this is pretty much Dante's view, right, in the Divine Comedy. There's heaven, hell, and purgatory. And all three of those are necessary in order to validate the goodness of the cosmos. And why do we need to believe in heaven, hell, and purgatory to begin with? Well, because again, if the cosmos is basically good, then you have to conclude that there's more to life than this, because justice doesn't seem to be very well enforced in this life. There are all kinds of scoundrels who prosper, and all kinds of good people who are ground underfoot. And if justice is going to triumph, that means that it's got to triumph in the long run. But people die, and so there's got to be a run longer than just this life, and so you have to look forward to the next life. Now, this is a kind of moral argument. It's a pragmatic argument, if you will, a practical or moral argument for believing in these kinds of things. And Socrates is very undogmatic about his conceptions of the afterlife, and in fact, they change from dialogue to dialogue. And in this, it's very clear that the basic Greek pragmatism about myth that's exemplified by their willingness to change their myths from circumstance to circumstance is something that Socrates, Plato, basically agree with. But what they do is they have a higher kind of pragmatism, if you will. It's not just political expediency, but the care of the soul that licenses this kind of attitude. And so they will transform these stories. First of all, they take up the inherited body of Greek myth and they transform it dramatically. Then they transform it into morally salutary stories, stories that are good for the care of the soul. Then, depending on the types of souls that they're dealing with, the particular characters they're talking with in the dialogue, they'll change the stories to fit the particular audiences. Now, the question that one immediately has to raise is this: well, isn't this just sort of cynical? Aren't they just lying? Aren't they just deceiving people? Well, if one holds to a very simple model of what truth is, yeah, it's just deception, right? But I don't believe that Plato holds to this kind of model of truth. If truth is simply saying it as it is, then clearly they're lying. But if one can give this kind of argument, namely that we have to make statements about things that we don't know anything about for sure, then we really can't have a model of correspondence model of truth, right? If you're going to talk about the afterlife, the only way of affirming the truth or falsehood of your views, the only way of testing it, is to die. Well, that means that on this side, we have to have other criteria besides the correspondence model of truth. So what is that model? Well, it's this pragmatic model, basically. The claim is that the cosmos as a whole is good. That's the basic assumption. And the goal is the very much this worldly care of the soul. And this licenses a somewhat cavalier attitude towards the inherited myths. So there's a lot of censorship that goes on, a lot of purgation of the myths of bad elements, and a willingness to change them from context to context, dialogue to dialogue, person to person. But the goal is always the same, namely the care of the soul, and the underlying assumption that generates all of these changes, namely the basic goodness of the whole, is the same. So, just to sum up, there are three basic reasons for why the Platonic dialogues are myths and contain myths. They are myths in the broad sense, and they contain myths in the more specific sense, right? The first reason is this. The images of myth are useful for self-understanding. The stories and images, the monsters, the heroes, and so forth, are useful for self-understanding. The language of myth, the use of narrative and poetic language to evoke concrete particularity, is useful for philosophy that regards the goal of philosophy as self-understanding and self-actualization. And the third reason is that myth is necessary to philosophy once philosophy recognizes, on one hand, the limits of reason in dealing with ultimate things, and on the other hand, the absolute moral necessity of having some views or beliefs about the ultimate things. If you have to have some beliefs about ultimate things, and yet you want to do so responsibly, you need to go to the myths, because they make claims about these ultimate things, and you have to apply two basic principles to them. One, again, is the principle of the overall goodness of the cosmos, and the other is the goal of self-cultivation. And with these standards, Socrates, Plato, both, I'll use the names interchangeably, take up the inherited myths of Greece and other cultures as well, and transform them in dramatic ways.